You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vivian Dorsal, editor and publisher of the literary journal Upstreet. Vivian Dorsal holds an MS in psychology from UMass Amherst and an MFA in writing from Vermont College of Fine Arts. She has also studied fiction writing in workshops led by Michael Martone, Lydia Davis, Jim Shepard, and Natalie Goldberg. Vivian was managing editor of the Berkshire Review for 8 years. She has coordinated and taught writing workshops for the Norman Rockwell Museum, the Jewish Federation of the Berkshires, Word Street, Pittsfield Reads, and The Big Read, and is editorial consultant for the Taconic High School student literary journal, The Double-Edged Sword. Vivian Dorsal lives in Richmond, Massachusetts, with her husband, Tip. Upstreet, which she founded in 2005, was recently awarded the bronze medal in the anthologies category of the 2008 Independent Publisher Book Awards. When I spoke to Vivian in July, I started out by asking about her background.
My background begins with Williams College, and I was a psych major, and I have a master's degree in psychology. I was in a PhD program, but I decided to stop that. And the first thing I did after that was edit two textbooks with my former psych advisor.
Oh, okay. So that got you interested in editing?
Yes. I had edited work for my husband's clients. He was a freelance graphic designer, and he had a lot of prep schools and colleges as clients, and I did work on his projects.
All right. And then you became a writer yourself at some point. When did that happen?
That happened when I got to be 50 years old and decided if I didn't try to do it then, I never would.
Uh-huh. And you got an MFA, I know that.
Yes.
And you used to edit another journal.
For 8 years, I was managing editor of the Berkshire Review, which came out of a writer's organization in Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Okay. So by way of introduction, I'm just, if I may, read something from the Upstreet website. Mm-hmm. Upstreet is an independently owned and published, nationally distributed magazine. It was founded in 2005 by Vivian Dorsal, formerly managing editor of the Berkshire Review for 8 years, who selected the members of the editorial staff for their love of the written word, their high standards of literary judgment, and their desire to offer a voice to prose writers and poets who might not find publication opportunities in more mainstream journals. So the journal's 4 years old at this point, almost? Or
I just published the fifth issue.
Okay. And so how is it going, like generally speaking?
It seems to be going better and better all the time. That doesn't mean it's making more money. It's losing. It probably always will lose money.
Is that just the life of a literary journal?
The ones that don't have academic support or grant support.
Mm. So do you survive mainly on subscriptions, or do you have advertising in the magazine? How does that work?
There is no advertising in the magazine. I just started taking subscriptions. I think I have maybe 4 subscriptions. It's hard to take subscriptions for an annual because a year subscription is one issue, so I take 2-year subscriptions. And that was Phil Graham's suggestion.
Okay. So what's a typical day like in your job?
It's very erratic because it depends on what stage the magazine is in, and I do it all from home, and I don't work in person with anyone else. So it's not like going to the office 9 to 5. In addition to working on Upstreet at whatever stage it happens to be in, I also sometimes teach little writing workshops. Mm-hmm. And I also conduct readings and those kinds of events, mostly in connection with the magazine.
Right, and I've seen those listed on the website's events link. So they seem to be pretty frequent. How often do you do those?
It was more frequent when I had a lot of local people in the journal. There are more and more people whose work is in the journal who are all over the world,
Okay.
Really.
Yeah.
It used to be, I started off with a base of local writers because the journal I worked on before was a regional journal. But this new issue, the most recent one, for instance, has only two poets,
okay,
who are from Berkshire County.
Uh-huh. And what's the distribution of poetry and prose in the journal? Does it vary, or?
It does vary, and it depends. I try to please all of my editors. There's a certain amount of territoriality about it. But it depends on what we get and what's good. In the fourth issue, for instance, I was actively trying to build creative nonfiction, and we also got a couple of pieces that were especially interesting. And so there is a skew in that issue towards creative nonfiction. For example, Douglas Glover has an essay in that one, and so does Michael Martone.
Oh, okay. Now, do you ever publish straight journalism in the magazine?
No.
So it's fiction, creative nonfiction, poetry?
Yes.
And is there any art component?
No, the only illustration in the book is the photograph of the author I've interviewed.
So what's your favorite part of the job?
There are a lot of things I like about it, but probably my favorite part is doing the interview.
Mm.
And I just discovered that with the third issue, because that was the first interview I've ever done in my life.
Uh-huh.
And that was Wally Lamb.
That would be a great interview. He's such a nice guy.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. So who have your interviews been?
The first two were done by Frank Tempone, who was the fiction editor at the time, and they were Jim Shepard and Lydia Davis.
Okay.
The three that I have done since then were Wally Lamb, Michael Martone, and Robin Hemley.
Oh, great. Now, what's your least favorite part of the job?
Both keeping track of sales and keeping track of book inventory, and part of the marketing part. It's hard to sell a literary magazine.
Right, yeah. Now, when you say marketing, you mean getting it into bookstores?
Yes.
How do you go about that? Just calling?
I have one distribution contract with Source Interlink, mm-hmm. which gives me Barnes & Noble. And I recently was contacted by Ingram Periodicals, who wanted Upstreet for the Hastings book chain.
Mm.
And so I have those two distributors. I also have had a contract for a couple of years with Ubiquity, which does independence, but I don't really have a sense of how many independents, because those small distributors won't tell you what their list of bookstores is, because it's proprietary information.
Okay. Now, when you say you're in Barnes & Noble through this certain distributor,
yes.
How many Barnes & Nobles will you be in? Is it very regional to your location?
No. It's all over the place.
Oh, so in Burlington, they probably carry Upstreet?
They probably do.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I know that when I went to Louisville to see my son, I looked in the Barnes & Noble there, and they had it. And I went to Salem, New Hampshire to visit a friend, and they had it in that Barnes & Noble.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's really hard to get into, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, because Barnes & Noble doesn't carry a lot of literary journals, do they?
No, not a lot.
Yeah.
There are some independents who do a beautiful job with that, but generally speaking, it probably depends on the area that the Barnes & Noble is in.
Right, okay. So Doug Glover's essay, how did that come about?
That happened 2 weeks before deadline, and that was one of the things that caused the emphasis on creative nonfiction in that issue,
okay.
In number three.
What's the title of his essay?
It's very long.
Or what's the subject matter of his essay?
It's about endings.
Okay.
The title is... this is great. The title is Don Quixote, Rosemary's Baby, Alien, and the French Lieutenant's Woman, Meditations on the Ideology of Closure and the Comforting Lie.
Wow. Now, when you receive an essay from someone like Doug, with whom I can say that you may have studied or you knew him through your master's program, is it intimidating to be his editor? Do you have to edit him?
I really asked him if I could make two changes, and that was all that was necessary, and he agreed.
Okay, so he was easy about it.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. Hey, do you ever have anybody who's not so easy about it?
No, I haven't really had a problem that way.
Interesting, okay. I'm wondering if you can read something from Upstreet that might help listeners get a feel for the journal's approach or something like that.
Okay. At the beginning of each issue, I do what I call the Upstreet essay, which is about 250 words, which I write myself.
Okay.
Just as a prelude, the title Upstreet comes from what we used to call the downtown shopping area of the town I grew up in, which is Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and we used to say, I'm going to go upstreet. So this is the one from Upstreet number 5. It was only a 15-minute walk from the noisy, bustling center of town, downhill, up again, and along one of those new side streets. She didn't know its name. Where a handful of houses stood, freshly painted and planted, and the rest of the grassy squares reclined expectantly in the sunshine, watching the cars roll by, waiting for the perfect buyer. They turned a corner, and all at once a farmer's field spread before them and stretched silently to the horizon. A whole new world, so close to everything she'd always known, hidden right there in the open. Suddenly, life was an adventure. He took her hand, guiding her from the blazing noon sunlight to the island of maples that stood in the newly mown field. The bright golden air filtered through the trees turned softly green, ruffling her hair and cooling her skin. His hand reached out to push aside the leaves, still moist with this morning's dew, and she followed, her sandaled feet stepping cautiously on the moss-cushioned ground. The only sounds she heard were her own breath and her beating pulse. At the heart of the copse, he paused. His hair shone blacker and his eyes greener than before, and when he smiled his slow smile, she leaned her head against the rough bark of the maple behind her. Then she was engulfed by the brilliant white of his t-shirt, the rich aroma of the Luckies in his pocket, and the sweet spearmint flavor of his tongue. It was the first time she'd ever been kissed.
So you do one of those at the beginning of each issue.
Yes. One time it was done by a friend of mine who also grew up in Pittsfield.
Oh, but. And they always sort of tie in something local.
Yes. The first one I did because I wanted to explain what upstreet meant. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. And I have done one ever since.
That's fun. That's different. I haven't seen that in any other journal. Have you?
No, I haven't.
No, I don't think so. What can writers do to make your job easier?
Follow the guidelines. When I am on panels or things like that, I am always asked what writers should do when they're submitting, and the answer is always follow the guidelines, and you would be surprised at how many do not. Because that's what they're told to do all the time. Read the journal that you're going to submit to. See if you think the work you do fits into what they have in there. And then do what they tell you to do. Because they do it for a reason. It makes their job easier. And it makes the editor's jobs easier. And if you are too blatantly defiant of the guidelines, you're just going to alienate them.
Right, and it makes your own job as a writer easier because you don't have to then send it out that many more times
trying
to find the right place.
Yes.
So your guidelines are on the website, and I want to mention the website is upstreet-mag.org.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I noticed that Upstreet has moved to using a submission manager for all submissions, like a lot of journals have done lately. How do you like that? What are the pros and cons of that system, do you think?
I do like it. Of course, it resulted in a lot more submissions. With regard to poetry, because people don't, as I said, follow the guidelines, I ask them to our limit is 3 poems per issue. I ask them to do each poem in a separate file. That is so I can count the number of poems we get. Some people do 3 in the file, and I can't monitor this. There are way too many, so it makes it hard to count them. It makes it easier for me to, I forward them. online to the appropriate editors. Mm-hmm. I used to have to print them when I took email submissions, to print them and then mail them to the different editors, one of whom is in Brooklyn, one of whom is in Denver, and one of whom is in Seattle. So it saves, the cost of the program saved me. It's a wash because I don't have to pay for the toner or the paper or the postage. Mm-hmm. But of course the editors have to read it on the screen instead of in hard copy, unless they want to print it, which will then cost them money.
Sure, right. Mm-hmm. So poetry, there's no issue with the formatting because it would be within like a Word file or something like that, right? And there's no issue with that. Yeah.
I specifically actually ask for Word or RTF files.
Okay. Do you offer personal feedback to writers ever?
Very seldom. I know some people, it's almost in some cases routine for them to say anything you can tell me that will help me will be appreciated, but there really isn't time to do that. I think some writers don't understand how much stuff we get and how difficult it would be to offer, you know, to be everyone's teacher. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did a blog post on that. It had to do with one submitter who really wanted to quarrel with me about the fact that I wouldn't tell her why it wasn't accepted. And that's a fairly unusual thing. Most people are professional enough to know that if it's not accepted, it's not accepted. And you can't always tell them why anyway.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting because as a writer, any writer knows that they're going to get a certain number of rejections. It just is the numbers game. It's how it is. It's the facts of life, and it's not personal, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything other than the fact that it didn't fit with what they were looking for at that very moment in time.
Yes.
Do you ever tell someone, look, if you'll look at this particular editorial suggestion, I might read it again and take it later, or...
We have done that. I think I can think of a couple of instances, and then it ended up not going in the magazine anyway. Mm. So it's difficult to do that.
Right, because you don't want to raise hopes.
No, I know.
Yeah.
And often a story or a poem won't go in because there simply isn't space. We work with a short list, and then the different editors, the three editors say, I ask them at the end to, okay, this is your short list, narrow it down to X number of stories, and then rank them. And I follow that as closely as I can. Mm-hmm. As I say, I like to please my editors. They don't get paid.
Yeah.
And their reward for doing what they do has to be to believe that they had a significant influence in what went into the magazine. And they do. Some of them have read for other journals and have said that they feel better about Upstreet than they did about their other reading experiences because they really feel like they influence what goes in. Mm. And in other cases, they felt like they had no impact on it.
They were just like a filtration system.
Yes. And in some big journals that have hierarchical systems of readers, that's exactly what it is. It's a filtration system.
Now, do you use any other readers than your editors? Do you use any graduate students or volunteers that aren't editors but contributing editors or something like that?
I haven't with nonfiction and poetry. I ask the editors if they want help. And Harrison Fletcher so far has done it all himself, and so has Jessica Greenbaum with poetry. This past issue, Robin Oliveira, the fiction editor, asked for help because it was looking like there were going to be 1,000 stories, and there were.
Oh my goodness.
And that's nothing compared with what places like Plowshares get. But it's a lot for Upstreet, and so we had a second reader, and with the next issue, we're going to have a third reader.
Okay. Yeah, and do you get more fiction submissions than anything else, or is it about equal?
No, we get overwhelmingly more poetry than anything else.
Right. Can you name a few highlights in the years since Upstreet started?
One highlight was getting a contract with Source Interlink.
Mm-hmm.
which made it possible. That was with the third issue and with the Wally Lamb interview. I think that had an impact on that.
And that's the distributor. Source Interlink is the distributor that got you into Barnes & Noble?
Barnes & Noble, and at the time Borders, and then Borders has since dropped us, but they are going to re-solicit Borders. I went back on the press for that issue because of the Source Interlink contract.
Okay.
And that was a highlight. Another highlight was the first Vermont College faculty member who sent me work, and that was Douglas Glover, who was an icebreaker.
I have heard that literary agents sometimes read journals looking for new talent. I'm curious if you're aware of that having happened with Upstreet, or if that maybe wouldn't come to your attention. But
yes, an agent contacted me when I had on the blog that Robin Olivera won the James Jones First Novel Fellowship. He asked for asked me to make it possible for him to contact her.
Okay, all right. Now, she's since published that book?
She's got a contract with Viking Penguin for 2010.
And what's the, do you know the nature of the book, or?
Yes, I do. She is the fiction editor, so she has not had anything in Upstreet. But it's a historical romance that's set in the Civil War.
Okay. We already talked a little bit about this, but is there anything more that you would want to add to the process of organizing some of the reading and speaking engagements?
Well, mostly they used to be around where I am, Berkshire County, and outside there near Northampton and in that area. But I've had one in Soho, New York, one in the Village at Cornelia Street Cafe, and most recently in May, I had one in Brooklyn at Book Court.
Oh, great.
I also did one for the AWP convention in Chicago this year in February.
Okay. So are you going to be in Denver?
I will.
And are you going to do one there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, that's good. So what mistakes, if any, do you see other journals making? And I'm not saying you have to name the journals. I'm just curious what your opinion is.
I'm not really aware of the workings of them. I think one of the things that has been said about Upstreet by its authors and by other people is that it's not just like being published in a journal. It's like being a member of the family.
Hmm.
Because of the blog, in which I think that's the primary reason, in which I talk about what the Upstreet authors have done. If they publish chapbooks, if they get a prize or something like that. I think many journals, of course they can't help it because of their size, are impersonal mm-hmm. towards their authors.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that all I can give them is attention or some kind of support because they don't get paid. I don't pay them for their work. I wish I could.
Yeah.
But because it's just a tradition that little journals don't pay, most of them don't pay the writers. Most of them are happy to get published, but still, I think everybody should get paid for what they do.
What funds a journal that can afford to pay people for their work? I mean, is that based on subscriptions, or do they have some sort of fundraising effort where they are, you know, collecting outside funds?
I think it is probably, if they are supported by an academic institution, such as, I'm not sure if Plowshares pays, but they are supported by Emerson College. I know that Tin House pays, and I was told that they have an angel, that there is a person who supports them.
Okay.
There are grants, and of course subscriptions and bookstore sales.
Right. Right. Okay. What are some of your favorite literary magazines other than Upstreet?
Well, I subscribe to, in addition to Writers Chronicle and Poets and Writers and The New Yorker, I subscribe to Tin House and One Story.
Okay. And one story is interesting. They only publish one story at a time.
They publish one story at a time about every 4 or 5 weeks, and they don't sell in bookstores. You just, if you subscribe for a year, you get this marvelous thing in your mailbox every 4 or 5 weeks. And I understand that they now have an imitator. I don't know what the title is, but Hannah Tinti and Mary Beth Batcha did this. And at the when it started, of course, it was unique. And I don't feel competitive towards other literary magazines, but I think this is great.
Yeah.
I think it is a great thing.
Yeah. So how many submissions do you tend to receive per issue? And of those, how many might, you know, be accepted for publication?
I think we have 10 in this most recent issue, 10 or 12 short stories. We got 1,178 stories.
Wow.
And that was out of a total submissions of more than 3,500.
Now, do you read year-round?
No. I did the first two times, I think, and that just is too difficult. Everybody needs a vacation.
Yeah.
So we're doing it from September 1st to March 1st.
Okay. So that's a nice long reading period.
Yes, and it comes out about around the 4th of July.
So how about poetry?
We get more than 2,000 poems.
Mm.
And
from how many authors, do you know?
Maybe 1,500.
Okay.
The limit is 3 poems. Most people submit 3.
Okay.
But some people will submit 1 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
And creative nonfiction is the least. We got about 350.
And how many might you publish from those?
About 8 or 10. But they tend to be shorter than fiction. The word count limit for both fiction and nonfiction is 5,000 words, but nonfiction tends to be shorter.
Is it easier to fit in a shorter piece?
After the editors give me their ranked lists, which is always more than will go in, I have to do some fudging towards the end of their lists, because whether the next one will go in or not will depend on whether there's space.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a certain number of pages to fill.
Right.
I also tend to use, this sounds terrible, I tend to use poems as fillers. If you have one page left, there's nothing usually that will go in except a poem.
Right, well, but it's a poem that's been selected as the next poem.
Yes,
that would
it is.
Fit well in the journal.
Yes.
Right. What's your policy regarding submissions from new and emerging writers?
I love to discover new people. I want the magazine ultimately to be a mixture of established and emerging writers. The established, it's always nice to get something from someone who's well known, but that also is what causes people to buy the magazine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
People don't usually want to pick up something that they look at the table of contents and say, I never heard of any of these people. It's unfortunate, but that's what people do.
And isn't that interesting, because editors will generally say they love discovering new voices. Readers
yes.
just don't want to discover new voices. They want to
it's
find
fun.
The ones
I,
they
wish
like.
They'd, I wish they they'd climb on the bandwagon, because it is fun to do.
Yeah, right.
And then you can say, I read him back when nobody knew who he was.
How does your role as writer affect your role as editor, and vice versa?
Actually, it's more vice versa. I try to write every day, if possible. But when the magazine gets busy, I have to quit. I really have to stop and concentrate on that. And when I'm doing that, I don't write anything. So publishing the magazine affects whether I'm writing or not.
So does that mean you're a very seasonal writer?
Sort of.
When does the magazine come out?
Around the 4th of July, right now.
So this is on bookshelves right now.
It should be.
Upstreet number 5.
Yes. It was shipped from the printer. I received it on July 1st, and it was shipped maybe the 2nd or 3rd to the distributors, and actually that means that Source Interlink won't be sending it to Barnes & Noble. It isn't on the bookshelves yet, really.
Okay.
Well, by August it will be. Having written fiction myself, probably makes me a different kind of reader, but I'm not the primary reader for these things.
Right.
So I don't know that my role as a writer affects what I do as an editor as much as my role as an editor affects more what I do as a writer.
As regards the time that you have. But what about material that you're working on? Does it change that very much?
I don't think so.
No.
No.
And have you tried other genres since you've started editing or anything like that?
Well, I do write an essay for each issue.
Right. So you don't write poetry, though?
No, I don't. Okay. I have three poems, I think, in print. But that was because my first writing teacher was a poet who also published fiction and nonfiction. But her name is Karen Chase, and she lives in Lenox, Massachusetts. And she would always give me a prompt and say, write a poem about... And most of the time she would say, that doesn't mean you have to write a poem. You can write anything you want. But sometimes I wrote a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't hurt a bit for a prose writer to write poetry.
No, right.
But I don't consider myself a poet at all.
And when you say you have three poems in print, you mean in the drawer at home, or you mean published?
I mean published.
Oh, okay. So you sent them out, and they
just
found
but
home.
They're just local. One is in the Artful Mind in Berkshire County. Another was in the Berkshire Review, and one was in the Connecticut River Review.
Okay, great. Who are some writers whose work you admire?
Alice Munro, primarily. I wish I could even figure out how she does what she does, let alone be able to do it myself. Before I discovered Alice Munro, my favorite short story writer was Frank O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
I also have liked Joyce Carol Oates. When I was very young, my favorite author was John Steinbeck.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, I admire Douglas Glover and Michael Martone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, there are so many. It's difficult. I've read so many people over the years, and it's a lot of years.
Yeah. Do you ever solicit work from certain writers?
Yes, I have done that a few times.
Yeah.
I've done it with poems.
Uh-huh.
And on a couple of occasions, I have solicited a short story. My poetry editor does also solicit work. Mm-hmm. She has a network of poets who live around the New York City area who she knows who are very good poets, and she has asked them to send work. On a couple of occasions, I think the fiction and nonfiction editors have also.
Mm-hmm. What advice can you offer to writers who want to break into literary journals, other than follow the guidelines?
Follow the guidelines. Today you can do a lot more than you could before journals took submissions online. I think practically everyone now submits simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there are many journals who don't want simultaneous submissions, but I know that writers submit simultaneously and don't tell.
Is that a dangerous thing to do, or?
If you're submitting to someone who doesn't want you to do that, then they'll never look at your stuff again.
Right.
But Upstreet considers simultaneous submissions, but you have to follow the rules. I want them to tell me. And that isn't a handicap. I mean, if you really like something, if the editor really likes something, it can cause them to say, well, we better take it before someone else grabs it,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the other way around. But I know that it takes 3 or 4 or 5 months sometimes to get an answer, and as a writer, I don't want to spend the rest of my life submitting things sequentially because life is too short. So I have this policy. But I still think that possibility causes people often to just do like a shotgun thing and submit to everything in sight.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't smart. It really isn't.
And if they don't take online submissions, it's expensive.
Yes, it is. I don't know, if you get the reputation for doing that, and I think there are people out there who are people know. I have talked to other editors. Oh, she sends everybody 20 poems, and they're known for this. So if you want to be taken seriously, do it seriously. Look at the journals and say, well, no, well, they wouldn't like this. It's not anything like what they do.
Mm-hmm. If you identify, say, 10 journals who you think this might fit in there, do you think that's too many?
It probably is.
Yeah.
Also, you should understand what level you're submitting at. Well, you can't submit to the New Yorker anyway unless you have an agent. But, because they don't even look at unagented short stories, for instance. But it doesn't really make any sense for a beginning writer, unless some miracle happens, to submit to the Paris Review and, you know, with all the top flight journals. They should realize that they probably aren't going to get into that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have any themes in Upstreet?
No, we don't.
You don't do theme issues because you're only once a year. So
we're only once a year. Maybe sometimes a theme will emerge accidentally. It's because everybody was writing about cats that year or something. I don't know. But it does seem that sometimes that we get, and that will affect whether something goes in. I remember specifically on one occasion that we had two stories that a cat was an important feature of the story, and Robin and I said, well, this is the better cat story.
Yeah.
So this sort of thing, but you can't predict that when you're submitting something, so yeah, that you shouldn't be affected by that.
Right. But it is something to take away from a rejection.
Yes.
Because it is the kind of thing that you could never know about.
No.
And to understand that really it's just not personal.
No, it isn't. Yeah. It isn't. And sometimes people say often, some book publishers that this is more common with, will send a letter saying, we thought that your novel was wonderful, but so why didn't you take it? And there are other reasons,
yeah,
often.
Right, right. Do you ever think of doing an online issue, you know, once a year, you know? No.
No, I don't. One of the things I do is on the website, I ask 4 different writers for each issue if I can put their piece that was in the print journal on the website. And so I have a short story, an essay, and 2 poems from each issue on the website.
Mm-hmm.
That is so that people who are interested in submitting can go to the website and see what sample content is.
Which is so nice because, you know, it's expensive to try to get a sample copy,
yes,
of everything out there.
I know.
Although it is the best way to do it.
I wish they would all buy a copy, but,
right,
but I know that's not going to happen.
Right.
They'll sit in Barnes & Noble and read it before. Because if a bookstore will let you treat the place like a library, a lot of people will do that.
Yeah. So what's coming up for Upstreet?
Probably an increased submission load. We're anticipating that for next year by having another reader for fiction. I haven't asked anyone to be the Upstreet number 6 interview yet, but I have to do that pretty soon, mm-hmm, because I always have to do my homework. What I do is read almost everything the person has written, if possible,
mm-hmm,
and then I send them questions ahead of time,
mm-hmm,
and it's a telephone interview.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the cover design. And who came up with the idea? Each Upstreet is a black paperback bound journal, and the word Upstreet is all lowercase in a different bright color.
Yes. Well, number 5 is purple, and that means of the 6 primary and secondary colors, I have 1 to go, so the number 6 will be orange. And I don't know what I'm going to do after that. It is my design. I did have a professional designer execute it, and put it on a disc so that, because I can't do that. But the typeface for the book, and particularly for the cover, was chosen from an array I put together by my husband, who is a retired graphic designer. And he is the one who told me, when I showed him several versions of it, don't capitalize the word Upstreet, because the U grabs everyone's attention.
Mm, that's interesting, and it's so attractive the way it is, all in lowercase.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's great.
I wish it didn't have to have a barcode on the front cover.
Yeah, that's too bad. Does it have to?
Yes, it does have to. And it has to if you're going to be distributed by the big distributors.
Oh, okay. Well, my last question, and I ask this of you because you're a writer as well as an editor, but, okay, but as an editor and as a writer, I'm wondering if you have any suggested exercise or activity that writers can turn to when they get stuck in their work or a piece of writing refuses to move forward, or what do you do in that situation?
Okay, I'm also a writing teacher. I have used Natalie Goldberg's Writing Down the Bones exercises and the ones in her Wild Mind. One of my favorites is just, I remember, and then that's a timed writing of 10 minutes, and then I don't remember.
That's good. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Okay. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you, Sheila.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Vivian Dorsal. Next Monday, tune in again to hear an interview with Doug Wilhelm, Vermont author of novels for young readers. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business. Located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Milton author Steve Delaney talks about the inspiration for his book, Vermont Seasonings, Wednesday, September 2nd at 7:30 at the Milton Historical Museum. Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex holds its regular open mic night on Wednesday, September 2nd from 6 to 8. More information about this event is available at 802-872-7111. The Power of Words Conference takes place each day from Thursday through Monday, September 3rd to 7th, at Goddard College in Plainfield. Single-day participation is also possible. Workshops and lectures explore writing, storytelling, drama, and music as ways to express thoughts and emotions. More information is available at 401-965-5353 or at tlanetwork.org. A homeschoolers book group will meet Thursday, September 3rd at 1 p.m. in the St. Albans Free Library. This book discussion for children ages 8 to 14 meets the first Thursday of each month. More information is available at 802-524-1507. Stepping outside of Vermont, I'll also announce that on Saturday, September 3rd at 7, if you happen to be in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, Chapters Bookstore at 78 North Street will be holding an Upstreet event hosted by today's guest, Vivian Dorsal, editor and publisher of the journal. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the interview you heard with Vivian Dorsal. During our conversation, she mentioned an exercise that she likes by Natalie Goldberg. A similar activity might be this. Try writing the words, "I used to," on a page. Then follow that with a 10-minute free write about something you used to do. Then write, "I'm going to," and write for another 10 minutes about what you're going to do. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m., Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.com. www.upstreetmag.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby's World of Music is up next at 3 o'clock with the best in today's world music sounds. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.